BBC News with Dee Sebastian. An international conference in London has reached agreement on the steps needed to pave the way for a viable Palestinian state. The meeting was chaired by the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair. He said failure to make progress on the Israeli-Palestinian dispute had contributed to poisoning international relations. He said the conference was no substitute for political negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians, but for these to succeed, Palestinian institutions had to be robust. The Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas said that his people were now confident the international community was very much concerned with their fate. The American Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, said prospects for Middle East peace were the best for many years. President Assad of Syria has said that Syrian troops in Lebanon might pull out within the next few months. The president gave no definite timetable, saying any withdrawal would depend on the security situation in Lebanon and Syria's own security concerns. Street demonstrations demanding a Syrian withdrawal have continued in Beirut. The United Nations Nuclear Monitoring Agency says Iran has refused to allow inspectors to revisit the Parchin military facility, which the United States suspects may have been used for work linked to the development of a nuclear bomb. Iran said it had gone beyond its obligations by allowing access to Parchin. The Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, has given a new job to a controversial militia commander, Abdul Rashid Dostum, who's accused of involvement in human rights abuses. General Dostum will become chief of staff to the commander of the armed forces. And the Supreme Court of the United States has abolished the death penalty for those who committed murder when they were under the age of 18. The ruling means that about 70 death row inmates in the US who face executions for crimes committed when they were under 18 will now not be executed. BBC News.
BBC World Service. Time now for our World Business Report. And courtroom drama is rare in accounting fraud trials, but there are exceptions. With news of one such case, here's Alex Ritson.
The former boss of WorldCom has been cross-examined in court as he gives his view of the $11 billion fraud which caused the company's collapse. With Bernie Ebbers' chances of remaining free hanging on his performance, we'll be hearing from our reporter who's been watching proceedings. We'll have the latest from the markets, where it was a positive day. The Dow Jones, America's blue chip index, rose 66 points by the close, a little more than 0.5%. And in the latest of our series profiling the biggest and most influential companies in Europe and America, we'll be looking at Citigroup, the largest financial institution in the world. But first, the man accused of masterminding the $11 billion accounting fraud at WorldCom has been giving his version of the events which led to the company's collapse. Bernie Ebbers has been cross-examined by prosecution lawyers under the watchful eye of the jury and the world's press. In his first appearance on the witness stand on Monday, he claimed that despite being the company's chief executive, he wasn't a financial expert. He blamed the crime on the government star witness Scott Sullivan, who was WorldCom's chief financial officer. Joined on the line by Janet Ball, who's been watching proceedings in court. Janet, Bernie Ebbers was very calm yesterday. Most observers thought he performed pretty well. How's he been performing today?
Well, as you say, yesterday he did a very good job. He was very jovial and friendly and smiled a lot and seemed very relaxed and calm when he told his rags-to-riches tale to the jury and scored some very strong points on his evidence that would have been quite convincing for the jury. Well, today it was quite different. I mean, obviously he was under some very strict, tough questioning. And it did show in his demeanour that, the pressure he was under, it was quite different. He appeared a little bit resentful of some of the questions. He was very impatient. Sometimes he seemed to dispute points that weren't worth disputing. There was at one point he was asked if he could remember speaking to the CFO, Scott Sullivan, one-to-one. And he was, oh, well, I'm not sure. I might have done. We tended to speak with other people. And there was a feeling amongst the people watching that he was disputing points that didn't matter. On the other hand, he did score some points for himself, and he did, if you like, have a ballsy approach to his defence in that he didn't back down when he disagreed with the questions being put to him, and he fought them well, shall we say.
So far, the defence has made a lot of the lack of the paper trail leading directly to Bernie Ebbers' office. Any sign yet of a smoking gun?
Well, I think we did see why so many people thought that it was so risky to put Bernie Ebbers on the stand, because the prosecution actually got to show four company reports, some internal documents that very clearly showed that the reported line costs, now these are the costs that the company were paying to other companies for the use of their lines, and it was the biggest cost the company faced, but they showed these line costs dropping by around half at the end of every of two quarters. So in September it was about 800 million at the end of the quarter they were paying for that 1 month. In July and August, they paid around 1.5 billion, which Bernie Ebbers said would have been more like what they should have been paying. So he actually said that when he looked through these documents on the court and were questioned about them, and these documents had been sent to him, and it was clear that he'd had them in his possession at least, they said to him, well, what do you make of this? And basically he said, if I'd seen it, anyone who'd seen it would have asked questions. I just didn't see it. I didn't read these reports. I just tossed them aside. I probably put this one in the trash, he said. And so that was his defence, that he hadn't seen it, that he'd withdrawn from that area of the company and of the business and had passed this on to other people. But whether that's convincing to the jury when they've seen in stark evidence, in black and white, these big numbers that just don't fit with each other and it seems so obvious, it'll be interesting to see what they make of it.
Thank you very much. We'll have to leave it there. It was a positive day on the markets, with America's blue chip index, the Dow Jones, rising 66 points by the close, a little over 0.5%. Chris Lowe at FTN Financial told me there's a lot of optimism about.
This is continuing on the gains from earlier this week as well. There's certainly a much better sense, a much more optimistic sense among investors as we continue to see good economic news.
This has been backed up by a quarterly survey of business leaders, a closely followed survey, which shows them more confident in the future than at any time since November 2002.
Yeah, that's right. The Business Roundtable surveys people who actually make investment decisions at corporations, and they're asking them precisely about their investment plans for the next year. And the survey jumped from about 98 to over 104, the highest, as you said, since 2002. And it's a good indication that we probably should expect to see capital spending pick up in the next 6 months or so.
Chris Lowe at FTN Financial. At the end of the trading day in London, the 100 share index closed up, same amount in percentage terms, 0.6% at 5,000 exactly. The BBC index of 20 leading companies in Europe and America up 0.1% on the day. Every $100 invested at the very peak of the market in January 2000, now worth $98.5, tantalizingly close to where it started. The euro down 0.5% at $1.31.9, the pound $1.92.1, and April Brent crude oil up 5 cents at $50.1 a barrel. The American giant Citigroup began life almost 200 years ago in New York City, and since then has grown to become the world's largest financial institution. It operates in more than 100 countries and has more than 200 million customer accounts. As a member of the World Service Index of 20 top companies, its shares are now worth 15% more than they were at the peak of the market in January 2000. But more recently, Citigroup has been implicated in various financial scandals in all areas of the world. In the latest of our corporate profiles, Louise Cooper looks at Citigroup.
The sounds of a trading floor, and Citigroup has many, where its employees trade billions of dollars of currencies, shares, bonds and other instruments every day. From investing your savings to insurance, business loans and credit cards, it's the first and probably only truly international one-stop financial shop.
The past decade witnessed the evolution of a new type of financial services company and a whole new model for the industry. It was a coming together of the best names in banking, insurance, and brokerage. This company is Citigroup.
In its last set of results, Citigroup reported record profits, net income of almost $12 billion for last year. This should have been a moment of triumph, but instead, the statement included a list of scandals that has cost the bank dearly. Citigroup expects to pay almost $5 billion to cover legal actions resulting from its relationship with the bankrupt telecoms firm WorldCom. The group is scheduled to pay the top American financial regulator, the SEC, almost $200 million after an investigation into commission payments. The firm's been forced to close down its Japanese private bank after repeatedly breaking local rules. In Europe, Citigroup traders made a huge but controversial trade in Eurobonds that disrupted the market and is currently under investigation. And the administrators of the bankrupt Italian food group Parmalat are taking legal action against the group. Serious mistakes have been made, admits Sally Korchek, Citigroup's chief financial officer.
2004 was not a good year for us. With these things coming up out of our past, I would argue some of those we were wrong. We need to make things right. And so, for example, the private bank incidents in Japan, we are very sadly exiting that market, being forced to exit that market. There are places where we have done some things which we should not have done. We need to make things right. We need to express our real regret for it. And we need to move on and make sure we're learning from it. There are other instances like Parmalat where we did nothing, in our view, nothing wrong. And we don't want to become an easy target for folks looking to get money out of the company. So that one we're going to fight tooth and nail.
So where did it all go wrong? Well, remember the 1980s, the era of booming stock markets, yuppies and shoulder pads, the decade of Thatcherism, privatizations and corporate greed, all summarized in the film Wall Street, with Michael Douglas playing the crooked financier Gordon Gekko.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit.
So greed was good. And according to one commentator, the problems emerging at Citigroup now are born out of this culture. Amy Stone is a journalist for Business Week and has co-authored a book on the previous chief executive, Sandy Weill, the man responsible for creating the Citigroup of today.
He was very hands-on. He was a very controlling manager who oversaw a lot of operations himself. And he did have an aggressive style. He emphasized profits. He wanted each division. He was very strict to make sure that it delivered their profit goals. And I think questions of ethics or corporate culture really took a back seat. So like a lot of corporate America, I think that came back to haunt them in the economic downturn and early 2000. And then to just say, well, Citigroup's gotten too big and too far flung, I think that's kind of too easy for them in a way.
And it was money that mattered in 1988 when Randy Newman recorded that song. And Citigroup is a child of that era. The group was created from a whole series of mergers and acquisitions, corporate practices that took off in the 80s. The pressure to make these deals work financially was high, tough profit targets were set, and executives could earn big bonuses. Changing the mindset from maximizing short-term profit to considering the group's long-term reputation is now a key management priority, according to the new chief executive, Charles Prince. Only a few weeks ago, he announced a whole series of initiatives. An ethics hotline is to be set up for employees, and in some way, a worker's pay will be more linked to the long-term health of the group. But can ethics education really change an organization's inbuilt culture? Sally Korchek thinks so.
I can tell you that this management team led by Chuck Prince has made it its number one priority to be the most respected financial services firm in the world. We take it very seriously. We're taking numerous actions, including compensation, reviews, all the things that get to the culture of an organization to make sure that we have a culture of the highest ethics that operates in the interest and only in the interest of our clients so that we can do a better job for them and be really, as Chuck would say, the company that we want to be.
The story of Citigroup reflects the broader changes in corporate America, from the greed is good culture of the 1980s to the more responsible capitalism that is becoming more prevalent. This is an industry, though, where reputation is everything. Already the company is losing business thanks to the scandals it's been involved in. The real test of the new boss, Charles Prince, will be whether he can change Citigroup, restore its battered reputation, and not announce any more regulatory mishaps in the next few years.
Louise Cooper, plenty more on our website, but for now, that's all from this World Business Report.
presented by Alex Ritson. A look at the news. An international conference in London has reached agreement on the steps needed to pave the way for a viable Palestinian state. The meeting was chaired by the British Prime Minister Tony Blair. He said failure to make progress on the Israeli-Palestinian dispute had contributed to poisoning international relations. President Assad of Syria has said that Syrian troops in Lebanon might pull out within the next few months. The president gave no definite timetable, saying any withdrawal would depend on the security situation in Lebanon and Syria's own security concerns. The United Nations Nuclear Monitoring Agency says Iran has refused to allow inspectors to revisit the Parchin military facility, which the United States suspects may have been used for work linked to the development of a nuclear bomb. The Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, has given a new job to a controversial militia commander who's accused of involvement in human rights abuses. We'll have full details of those and other stories in our next news in some 14 minutes' time. BBC World Service, and now analysis. This week, the Australian government will extend its maritime security zone beyond its own territorial waters in order to combat the perceived threat from global terrorism. The move has been greeted with concern from some of Australia's neighbours, notably Indonesia and Malaysia. Some experts are questioning how necessary the extra measures are, given the existing international agreements and bodies charged with policing the oceans. Claire Penketh now looks at the different arguments over how best to maintain security on the high seas.
It's not, as I read in the newspaper this morning, an attempt to extend Australian jurisdiction. It's an attempt to obtain earlier knowledge of the details of shipping that either intends to visit Australian ports or transit Australian waters.
In December, the Australian government announced its intention to extend its maritime security zone to 1,000 nautical miles. That's about 48 hours sailing time from their ports. The new zone would go deep into foreign waters. Defending the move, Australia's Defence Minister, Robert Hill, said the proposals responded to Australia's need to talk to ships heading for its shores, along the lines of what already happens with aircraft. But Malaysia and Indonesia both condemned the plans, saying it violates their sovereignty. Marty Natalegawa, spokesman for Indonesia's foreign ministry, said that although his country's 14,000 islands might be difficult to patrol, that doesn't mean other countries have the right to give unwanted help.
It's our responsibility and our challenge to try to address whatever security problems that we have. That doesn't mean that willy-nilly other countries can simply try to do the job for us.
At least 182 people have been killed in a terrorist attack on the Indonesian holiday island of Bali. A massive bomb devastated...
The Bali bombing in October 2002, in which just over 200 Australians died, changed forever Australians' perception that it was somehow insulated from the dangers faced elsewhere in the world by virtue of the country's remoteness. Fears of attacks was a central theme in last year's election campaign in Australia, as Prime Minister John Howard sought re-election. He even suggested setting up mobile teams of anti-terrorist police, available to neighbouring countries.
If we are re-elected, I'll ask that Mr Downer and Senator Ellison to go around the region and talk to their counterparts without being specific. We know from discussions that have already occurred at a police and agency level that this initiative will be very warmly welcomed in the region.
Once in office, the Prime Minister followed up on some of these proposals and included the maritime extension zone. But what does it actually entail? Don Rothwell is Professor of International Law at the University of Sydney.
These initiatives involve the establishment of what the government's calling a 1,000 nautical mile maritime identification zone, within which all vessels intending to visit Australia will be required to identify themselves once they enter that zone.
Is that legal?
Well, I would take the view that under the international law of the sea, which guarantees the freedom of navigation, the requesting of this information, albeit fairly basic information, would be considered by a number of countries to be a breach of the freedom of navigation, which is a very long-held and cherished right of the seas, under which vessels on the high seas shall not in any way have their freedoms of navigation interfered with. And given that this identification zone would certainly be operating on the high seas adjacent to Australia, I think many countries could take the view that that's a breach of the freedom of high seas navigation.
And according to Professor Rothwell, it won't be easy to implement.
The proof will be in the pudding as to how actually the government implements the initiative. The announcement in December was somewhat short on detail, and so there's great anticipation as to how the government, and in particular the Navy, will actually go about implementing these initiatives. And inevitably, of course, one will have to await the response of the flag states whose vessels are being stopped and inspected to see how they respond. If they respond negatively and protest this action, we could well see some significant international incidents arising.
Is that likely?
Yes, I think it is, because while Australia has good cooperative relations with a number of countries who are working collaboratively to deal with maritime security issues, that's not the case with all states whose vessels enter Australian waters. And some of those states very fiercely pride the right of the freedom of navigation. It's been a traditional aspect of the to and fro of the development of the law of the sea over 200 or 300 years. So I expect that some states will react quite negatively if Australia is seen to be taking too aggressive a stance.
But how real is the threat to the world's shipping? Over the past 20 years, there's only been a handful of incidents on the open seas. Brigadier Brian Parrott runs an international maritime security consultancy based in London.
It started basically with the Achille Lauro. You remember in 1985, one American citizen was murdered by Palestinian terrorists. And the American reaction was that there should be an international system which gave the same degree of security for people who travel by ship as we have with the aircraft. And so in 86, an American admiral came over to the IMO, which is the United Nations organization dealing specifically with maritime affairs, and after some discussion, the international community agreed a set of guidelines to unify and set procedures for security on ships and ports.
But those guidelines were not compulsory, and that was before the attacks on the US on September the 11th, 2001. As the US and its allies reassessed security in the light of those attacks, many felt shipping could potentially be a soft target. The United States pushed for the establishment of an international agreement called the Proliferation Security Initiative, or PSI.
One of the most successful initiatives of the Bush administration, and surprisingly multilateral, was the so-called Proliferation Security Initiative.
Ruth Wedgwood is a security analyst from the Johns Hopkins University in the United States.
It was just a set of principles that countries were invited to agree upon, and a set of maritime exercises in the hope that one could use the navies of a great many countries to make it a whole lot harder to ship WMD fissile material or precursors by sea to irresponsible countries from irresponsible countries.
According to Ruth Wedgwood, the PSI has worked more as a practical approach to the problem, rather than a more cumbersome governmental treaty.
Well, there have been a series, again, of meetings and naval exercises. It's kind of mill-mill relationships, very, very worker-y, very low-key. No one was required to sign a piece of paper. What it basically works on is permission, that you would look for legal ways of having delegated authority from countries that you may board vessels and inspect the cargo of your partner countries.
But in addition, the U.S. has also pressed for the International Maritime Organization's regulations to be strengthened. The IMO is an agency of the UN, and Chris Trelawney, its senior technical officer for maritime security, says its job is to act as a broker between its member nations.
The IMO, as such, is not a policing organisation. It's a communication organisation between member governments. So the actual policing is carried out by the member governments themselves, responsible for their own areas.
Is this effective?
It is effective insofar as